is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
On Friday, September 27th, the Norris Group proudly presented its 12th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts join Bruce and Aaron Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, massive tech disruption, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. All proceeds from the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event is not possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club, Think Realty, Coach Fullerton, Keller Williams Corona, Property Radar, the Apartment Owners Association, MVT Productions, and Realty 411. Visit isurvivedrealestate.com for event information.
So what's all right, let's talk about the next recession then and the ramifications on our industry price-wise. So is there any consensus, like would you say we're going to have a recession in the next 12 months? Let's just say yes, no, or maybe?
I'll say no.
No?
Okay. I don't know.
I think we're already starting to see early signs of it. It's definitely obviously not going to be anything like 2007, 2008, but in the next 12 months, sure, I'll say yes.
Okay.
You'll say yes?
Sure.
Yeah, I believe there has to be a small correction. I do.
Okay. Now, okay, Sean.
I think that we don't have a market economy, and I think with our current administration, we would throw anything at not having a recession.
Yeah, we built an index to predict recessions, and normally within the 2 years there's a 27% chance, and according to the data it's a 75 right now, so I'd say that's probably yes, but I agree with him, they'll throw the kitchen sink at it if it's coming.
Okay.
Yeah, well, we don't have the same numbers as John, but the risks are rising. And we're never able to predict exactly when they happen, but the 12 to 18 month time period is
okay.
Is,
well, so here's let's go through the process of okay. We get a recession, and we're gonna prevent it from getting worse. So the first thing Fed does is lower interest rates by typically 4 to 5%, and we.
They don't have that.
We don't have that.
Uh-oh. Sure we do. We can go negative.
Well, there you go. I read that. You can go negative. It's in a report I read. It's not a big deal.
Must be true. It was written in a report, right? Yeah. Well, so if you look at sovereign debt around the globe, take the U.S. debt out of the picture, 50% of sovereign debt is paying negative yields.
Yeah.
That's $17 trillion, right? So
and you pay them to have your money.
Yeah, now at the beginning of tonight, I think I mentioned something to the effect, and I just lost my thought, can you believe that? Well, I'll tell you what was funny. I sent most of the people on the panel an email because we were messing around with the idea of negative interest rates. I said, so, okay, hypothetically, you owe $1 trillion and you'd be able to get a 50-year loan at minus 2%. You would never have to make a payment. It would resolve itself in 50 years just by taking your interest credit. So I thought, that would be good. Okay, so if we have a recession and we don't have that weapon, and by the way, what I was going to say is those countries really are not at the end of their negative cycle, they're at the beginning of their negative cycle. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Do you think that? Well, like Germany or whatever is going negative, is it going to get more negative?
Well, there's no question their economies have slowed.
Right.
In fact, the Germans were, depending on how you define it, were in recession for a little bit. They're heavily dependent on trade and on manufacturing. And both of those things have been slowing because of the trade debates that are underway. So if you want to see Germany shudder, all you have to do is use the words car tariffs, because that's Germany. Okay. So no question, around the globe, things slowing, which is part of the reason that rates are where they are.
Okay, so the Fed can only lower so far, then it starts injecting money?
One of the things that Powell did say in an answer to a question was that it was put the damper on the idea of negative rates. So that is, I think, the evidence that the central banks around the world have seen is that it really hasn't helped growth. But yes, they would ease, they would expand the balance sheet, they would offer whatever liquidity services they could in the industry, but then the rest would have to be done by the fiscal policy. Tax cuts probably would come through.
What they're controlling is the short end, mm-hmm. basically. Mm-hmm. If you had negative rates that got into pretty negative territory, there's an IMF report I read, it was -3%, and they were trying to figure out ramifications of that. So what would happen to our 10-year if something like that was to occur somewhere else? Would we have that invert to quite a low number? I'm just curious.
Well, for those institutions, global institutions who do not have regulatory requirements to hold sovereign debt from their nation, which we do, for example, our banks have to hold treasuries as part of their capitalization, or asset classes for liquidity and safety issues. So some of the institutions overseas hold those securities that debt, even though it's going to generate a negative yield over the course of life because of regulatory requirements. But if they are not burdened by that, part of the reason long rates in the U.S. are low is because capital flows to the U.S. because it is a positive return.
Yeah, that's right? My point. If it would be positive, even if it was less negative than where it was coming from.
That's where expanding the balance sheet, increasing the size of that balance sheet will come in to attempt to hold those rates up.
Okay. So we have a recession. Does it cascade into lots of foreclosures this time and therefore have a negative impact on prices?
No. But the whole regulatory framework changed in 2009, right? The regulators pre-2009, required that banks get rid of bad assets as fast as possible at any price. And as soon as they changed that, the course of the foreclosure crisis changed. And I'm not good enough on the history of the previous ones, right? But we let the savings and loans fail, right? And they kind of said, oh, we learned a lesson there. We're not going to do that next time. So, I think we learn something each time. We'll make a new mistake next time, but it mm-hmm. won't be that.
Well, go ahead.
So I'll agree with Sean, but I'll put a different twist on it. So I think if there's a recession and people stop paying their mortgages, the servicing companies are required to foreclose on them. So I think we're going to see the foreclosure process started. I think the lesson learned this cycle was SNL last cycle was there's going to be a huge amount of money raised to do non-performing loans, and you can sell the pool to non-performing loans. And now you have all these rental companies. They'd be like, I'd love, give me 1,000 homes with somebody in them that I can restructure as a tenant, I'll take it. And the federal government, actually, we had conversations in 2009 with Doug at Fannie and Freddie and FHA about FHA becoming the landlord in this situation, and they just couldn't do it. I think they're gonna find a solution next time. And the other thing is if they really do hit the market, I've asked American Homes to Rent and Invitation Homes and all these guys this question, like how soon are you guys gonna start gobbling them up? And their answer is as soon as the yields make sense. So
yeah.
So
it's
the
floor.
Odds of like a 40% price decline or even a 20% are pretty low in that, in my view. And I actually think those guys would see a lot of new money come in and compete with them.
I think the other thing that is out there is given the shortage of supply relative to the level of demand, if the recession is mild, say unemployment runs to 7.5%, you still have 92.5% of households working.
Right.
Interest rates come down because the Fed eases. The demand curve backs off because of unemployment. But for those that are still employed, that means price appreciation is slower or maybe zero. And interest rates are great. Pretty good time to buy a house. especially if there's a foreclosure that
from,
you're aware of.
From the lending side, you know, what I've witnessed is, I mean, an unbelievable effort to not foreclose on houses in the last bunch of years.
It was sort of drinking out of a fire hydrant, right, for these institutions. They'd never seen that kind of volume coming through of delinquent notes and obviously foreclosures. I mean, I remember I actually at one point had an asset management firm that operated out of all 50 states, and one of my clients was Bank of America. They had 1.2 million delinquent notes. And I thought, okay, this contract for me is going to last forever, right? But, you know, lo and behold, they started selling off their notes left and right. And literally over about 6 month period, it went from 1.2 to like less than half that, right? And so I do think there's huge appetite to buy. And I'm not sure whether, you know, people will be able to buy, you know, 30 cents on the dollar or 40 cents on the dollar like they used to last time around. That certainly isn't going to happen. But you also have a situation, I think, right now. The average down payment of what Fannie Mae, what is it? Like, it's probably like 68 LTV. What is the LTV on your typical book of business right now?
Oh, gosh. I'll get a number then. Somebody from Fannie Mae.
You can just make something up and no one will know.
Yeah. Well, 84% of statistics are made up. So.
Yeah. I mean, but the down payment cushion is quite substantial, even for FHA right now. And so I just, you know, it would require a pretty big hit in terms of price depreciation for, I think, big kind of flow of foreclosures and all that to happen. You know, from a lending institution point of view, I mean, obviously, you know, a lot of the community banks that hold the notes, I mean, that they obviously would get hit. People that are selling into the market, a lot of the independent mortgage banks, they, unless they've done something wrong in terms of originating that loan, they probably don't have any repurchase risk related to it. So it just sort of depends on who you are. And my guess is that we will not see what we experience in, you know, 08, 09, 10.
I don't think we'll deal with anything like that quantity, but I was thinking that the consumer kind of has been taught, I'm going to get a hug and get a recast and a 2% mortgage, and they're going to put it on the back end, or they're going to forgive it, and I can stay here for 4 years without a payment. I mean, that's what they just experienced.
Yeah, well, they did experience that, but you also had about 5 million people who actually lost their home.
Yeah, that was the first round, and that's when they went, we better not do
that. Yeah, so I think the pain of those 5 million people are still kind of alive and well. Obviously, there are people who got the pass, you know, they got... You know, they didn't have to pay a mortgage for 3 years or whatever it was, you know, and you certainly had those situations. But I do think just the general perception in the market is people got hit pretty hard. You know, a lot of people literally lost their home and really lost their kind of their trajectory in their life, right? So, and people are just kind of recovering from all of that now. And I don't know if it will be viewed as this kind of positive experience that somehow they'll get saved through the process. So.
Yes, or when you lean forward, I think you're going to say something. Okay. It's like, never mind. All right. The economic policies that have been in place for quite a while, have they benefited the asset holder versus the wage earner? And if so, what are some of the ramifications of that we're seeing?
You just answered your own question, Bruce.
Yeah, I did answer my own question. You're right. So we're seeing these things, and you know, like almost it's on a daily basis. So I read something, and they just floated a net worth tax. That was a new one, up to 8% of your of your net worth if it's over $100 billion a year. Okay, I mean, but what used to seem like completely ridiculous is now like being considered, that's kind of reasonable. And that's scary stuff, because now you've got a kind of a list of stuff, you know, college debt forgiveness, free medical, and I just think, okay, is this going to ultimately change some policies that are going to be really expensive for the U.S. economy? I guess that's where I was going with that.
I mean, you look at the whole rent control thing, right, in the state, right? I mean, it's going to have a detrimental impact on the investment side and frankly the property, but because of the pain people are feeling, they are willing to go down this path.
That's right.
And so it's there's no real good answer. There's got to be a really solution for the consumer and the renter when they're paying, you know, 40-50% of their income into
never
rent.
Gonna be an owner.
Then you have people making irrational decisions to support something that's going to over the long haul hurt the industry and frankly consumers. So I don't know. That's why you're having this kind of wild swing in political debates right now.
Right. Well, the reason what you just brought up was interesting because when we got the rent control, I emailed, and I don't remember if it was you, but I said, I don't recall voting on that.
Yeah, you did.
Because I do recall voting on it last year, and it was no.
Yeah.
And we didn't get to vote on this one, and it was
Prop
10.
Yes.
Okay, so I guess, and the reason I was like tongue-in-cheek, going, okay, what else don't we have a right to say no to, or if we say no, they can trump it? So Prop 13. Prop 13's coming up on the ballot, not for the house portion of it, but for everything over 4 units, right? Okay, so I actually thought it has a good chance to pass, not that I wanted to, but if it doesn't pass, is that something they can trump and say, well, we disagree, we're going to go there anyway? That's astonishing.
Well, if it passes together with rent control, now, right, your taxes are going up every year, but you're being capped on your rent, so it's going to be a margin squeeze, you know.
But isn't that what they would like?
Oh yeah, clearly.
Yeah.
And you know, but it's going to end up in, you know, well, yeah, less supply, less being built, you know, and other issues. I don't know if everyone, you know, Sanders has his proposal of a 25% tax on flips, which should be of interest to everybody in this room. So every flip would get taxed at 25%.
an extra 25.
I think you can thank Adam Data Solutions out there because they keep talking about how much money everybody's making.
Oh, I know.
Flips.
Oh.
And
oh,
what they're doing is they're taking the purchase price and the sale price, and they're taking the gross number. Like, how many of you have achieved that? Like zero expenses, right?
No cost of any kind.
But that's what all these folks believe. They think we're just, you know, everybody who's flipping a property is making all this profit. We got to tax 25% of it.
Yeah.
I mean, that talk about dangerous statistics. You know, everybody in this room needs to call Adam and tell him to knock it off.
I was on a radio show and they challenged me with that, and I said, well, it's just the most ridiculous formula. So here's what the real deal is. Anyway, okay, I got to ask this one question because last time there was a big pile of residential debt that caused problems. Is there big corporate debt bonds that could tilt over and be downgraded that could cause a liquidity problem? And I guess the secondary question, are there side bets against the outcome of those bonds that are enormous in size?
That's interesting. I mean, the WeWork thing, right, is really interesting. You look at the amount of money that, you know, SoftBank, right, so you've got WeWork, Opendoor, Compass Real Estate, right, Katerra on the construction side. I mean, these are like $500 million or larger investments in each of these things. And I think as a thesis, it's a good thesis, right? Real estate is ripe for disruption, right? I think we're all hearing and talking a lot about that. But there's a lot of money just in those, like, and so if you take that and go out wider, right, like, how these iBuyers are working, right, is they're raising a lot of capital. And are they doing it to make really great, you know, investments? And could that go wrong? And could it go wrong in a big, bad way? And how broad or wide is that, right? I think there's a lot of risk there.
If you look at non-financial corporate debt, the share of it that is rated high yield or triple B is the highest it's ever been.
Okay.
And in the triple B's are some companies that have regulatory requirements that they can't hold securities lower rated than that.
Right.
So one of the potentials is if there's a shock in capital markets that downgrades those triple B's, there's a bunch of companies that would have to make an adjustment, and there's a question, given the liquidity discussion we were talking about earlier, whether that liquidity exists in the market for them to make that shift. It's one of the consequences of a long-term low interest rate environment that the low cost of credit keeps firms in business that would naturally have exited the business at a higher cost of credit. So that is a risk.
How comfortable, like in one of the movies, there was a discussion about the ratings and how they were not accurate. So they had, you know, these tranches of AAA rated garbage, and that's what these guys were betting against. So when you have corporate debt that's got a rating, is that rating system now been cleaned up to where we feel that that's really telling the truth, or is that a competitive business where if you don't give a rating, you don't get business? I'm just curious.
I think the problem there is we're always looking in the rearview mirror, right? So we're saying, geez, these loans we made last year were really good and they haven't gone bad, so we can loosen up a little bit.
Yep.
We keep loosening up because we're looking in this rearview mirror and things are just, well, they made the payments last year, we can get a little looser. And I think that is absolutely the issue until you reach a point where there is some sort of little thing and then suddenly there's no market for that debt and it becomes a big thing.
Are there bets against the outcome of other people's investments to a big extent?
Not to the degree that it was during the crisis.
Okay.
But there are still derivatives, significant numbers of derivatives out there. And the worry in the derivative space today is how many of those are tied to LIBOR, which they're trying to replace with SOFR, a different index. I see the Federal Home Loan Banks were just given some guidance to be moving off of LIBOR by the FHFA. So there's some risk in that space.
Okay.
And I think Glass-Steagall and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act had more to do with the last crisis than anything else. We didn't fix either of those.
All right, we are almost out of time, so I am going to ask, repeat the question I had asked before. You can answer one or both of them if you want. Anything keeping you up at night, like a black swan event? And what's the one thing you're most excited about for 2020?
Okay, it's late, so I'm gonna give the same answer to both. The elections.
Okay.
Keeps me up at night. I'm looking forward to it for 2020.
Okay. So. All right. Fair enough.
I think what's keeping me up at night is if you've seen the Realogy stock lately, it's unfortunately a bit lower than, you know, our profitability and our operating sort of expertise would show. So, you know, that definitely weighs on me a lot. But I also think that as some of this hype boils over in the marketplace, that, you know, sound operating sort of margins and discipline will prevail in the next year. And we're going to round a corner. So, you know, kind of like Jim said, it's sort of the same thing, just two edges of the sword.
Yeah, what keeps me up at night is actually kind of different than this. It's actually the erosion of the trades in this country. I can't imagine how far down we're going to go if this trend keeps going. And then, you know, what really gets me excited, although artificial intelligence is an oxymoron, it's really not intelligent, it's actually how much more thinking we can do if we start relying more on machine learning.
Interesting.
Great. I am thinking 100% of the time about we, after being in just five states for 12 years, are right on the cusp of going national, and I'm working on that 24/7. and that's also what I'm looking forward to most, is getting through that and being done.
What keeps me up at night is I've got 72 employees, so I've got a lot of payroll. So navigating through all the changes in the world, the election and everything else is actually something I'm excited about next year too. But it's what I don't know is what I worry about. And you asked one of the key questions. Nobody tracks the derivatives that are going on with all that crappy junk debt. So nobody knows the answer to your question. And that scares me.
Spicy foods eaten late. teenagers. I think the thing that bothers me the most is that all of us have grown up with an interest rate path that future rates are higher than today, which is an encouragement to to put off consumption and save, which is one of the fundamentals of a capitalist system. And the perversion of that through what I, very unorthodox monetary policy, really, that really worries me because of that huge outstanding amount of debt globally. It's the largest it's ever been. That definitely keeps me up at night. What I'm optimistic about, and this is not to be obsequious, is what happens here, watching the videos of these children, which is they're all our future, and the investment that people here make in that, and I'm very optimistic about the future of the country.
Thank you very much. I guess I will end by saying that I've ended it this way like every year for the last 10 years. My biggest wish is that every politician would not be a Democrat for the next 4 years or not be a Republican, but be an American. Yeah. And that we would do what's best for America, not for whatever. Aaron, where are you, my friend? How about we give Aaron an ovation for putting this baby together? He does. Thank you all. Drive safe. We'll see you next year.
The Norris Group originates and services loans in California and Florida under California DRE License 01219911, Florida Mortgage Lender License 1577, and NMLS License 1623669. For more information on hard money lending, go to thenorrisgroup.com and click the Hard Money tab.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Coldwell Banker Town & Country, Inaday Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, LA South RIA, Michael Ryan and Associates, NorCal RIA, NSDREI, Orange County Real Estate Investors, Pacific Premier Bank, Pasadena Phoebe, Shenbaum Group, SJREI, Spinnaker Loans, South OC RIA, UDirect IRA Services, White House Catering, Wilson Investment Properties. See isurvivedrealestate.com for event information. For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.